Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing, and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the very latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org. This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Last Sunday, police in Kenosha, Wisconsin, shot a man multiple times in the back as he entered his car with three children inside. That man was Jacob Blake, a black resident of Kenosha. Blake survived and remains in the hospital. Family members say he's now paralyzed from the waist down. The protests began almost immediately. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers called in the National Guard. Fires erased entire city blocks, and early this morning, three people were shot and two killed during a confrontation between protesters and armed men who claimed to be protecting a gas station. 3 months after the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, nationwide protests are still happening. Black people are still being killed by police, and families and communities are still seeking justice. Joining me to discuss what's happening in Kenosha is Gina Barton, an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Gina, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, can you start with the latest? What do we know about the shooting last night?
Last night, there were armed militia groups on the scene of the protests in Kenosha. They were calling themselves the Kenosha Guard, and some of them were actually taking sniper stances on the roofs of buildings and things like that. Around midnight is when the craziness started, and our understanding is that a man with a long gun shot one person in the head and then started walking away. A couple of other people tried to disarm him, and then he fired some more, killing another person and wounding a third, and then just walked away. And our understanding is that police cars screaming down the street saw him, and he was standing there with his hands up, but they didn't seem to realize that he was the shooter.
Has there been any response from the city or police?
The sheriff, David Beth, gave some statements last night. Understandably, he's really shaken by all of this, is urging people to stay home tonight. We had 250 National Guard troops out last night. They've already asked the governor for several hundred more to try to keep things in control this evening.
Let's go back to the beginning with Jacob Blake. What happened the day he was shot?
The day Jacob Blake was shot, he was barbecuing for his son's 8th birthday, and the police got a call about a domestic incident occurring. Now, Jacob Blake did have an open warrant for a previous domestic violence situation, but we're not sure at this point if he actually was involved in the situation that the police were called for on Sunday evening. Police are saying they believe he was. Bystanders are saying he was actually trying to break up a fight between two women. So in any case, the Kenosha police arrived, and a new video that just surfaced yesterday shows Jacob Blake on the ground struggling with two officers. And his attorney has said he was tased. And then you see him get up and walk very slowly around the front of his SUV to the driver's side. And that's where the now famous video comes in. You can see two police officers with their arms extended, holding their guns, following him. Everybody's walking very slowly. He opens the car door, and then one of the officers grabs him by the shirt, and almost immediately you could hear seven shots and then the car horn as his head slumps onto the steering wheel. And then a woman who's also in the frame starts jumping up and down and screaming.
We reached out to the Kenosha Police Department for a statement by phone. They told us they aren't commenting at this time and that there's an ongoing Department of Justice investigation. In the immediate aftermath of that event, how did police respond? How did they explain what happened?
The police have not given much of an explanation for what happened at all. They put out a pretty vague statement about the fact that there was an officer-involved shooting, and that's about it. The Department of Justice has also been really tight-lipped on what's going on. Some experts that we've talked to have said that the only way this sort of shooting someone in the back when he has nothing in his hands, the only way that that could have been justified is if perhaps there was a gun on the front seat of the SUV that you can't see in the video and he was trying to grab it and then turn around and shoot the officers. I think that's unlikely because I think if that had happened, the police certainly would have shared that information publicly as they usually do.
Jean, what happened in the immediate aftermath of the shooting on the scene?
Emotions were high immediately, as I'm sure you can imagine. The thing that is really troubling to me is not only were there three children in the car, but there were also children on the other side of the car. This was a barbecue for a child's birthday party. So people got really upset and really emotional very quickly. And that first night, Sunday, as soon as that video started circulating, crowds started gathering and the protesting began.
And how did the state respond to those protests?
The first night of protests, there was not very much state response. There was a relatively calm protest at first, and then the police didn't seem like either they didn't know what to expect or they were optimistic that it was going to stay peaceful. Later in the evening, right away Sunday, things started getting bad. And so Monday night, Governor Evers activated the National Guard with 125 troops. And then last night, there were 250 troops, but even that was not enough to prevent the double homicide and shooting last night.
Well, Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers held a press conference on Monday. Let's listen.
This movement has touched every corner of Wisconsin. And frankly, I should not need to call special session when people across our state, from streets from my small hometown of Plymouth to the streets of Milwaukee, are demanding their elected leaders take action. Leaders show up. Leaders do the work that needs to be done and that the people demand of them. But we cannot wait for Republican leadership to show up for work because clearly they intend to keep us waiting. That's not going to cut it. Not for me, not for Lieutenant Governor Barnes, and certainly not the people of the state who are leading at this time and in this moment.
In that press conference, Governor Evers mentions a package of legislation to increase accountability and transparency in Wisconsin police forces, but he says the legislation was stalled. Can you explain what's happening there?
In our state, the governor is a Democrat, but the assembly is completely controlled by Republicans in both chambers. So ever since Governor Evers took office, they've been butting heads about what to do and when to do it. So any of these police reform bills have had a really hard time being passed, even things such as banning chokeholds and some of the ideas that came to light almost immediately after the death of George Floyd. So right now, Governor Evers is calling a special session. He wants legislators to come back and take up some of these bills on police reform. The Republicans, for their part, have different ideas. So one of the Republican leaders is saying he wants to have a committee study the issue before they introduce any legislation. Then we have another Republican legislator who is a former police officer from Racine, Wisconsin, who is interested in putting forth a bill that would investigate police shootings and other violent incidents the same way the National Transportation Safety Board investigates plane crashes with an eye toward prevention rather than accountability. So even though both sides seem to agree that something needs to be done, they don't agree on what needs to be done or how to do it.
We're talking to Gina Barton. She's an investigative reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We'll continue this conversation. And coming up, the protests over Jacob Blake's shooting are just the latest in a long line of demonstrations that have erupted this summer. We go back to one of the first cases to grab national headlines this year and see what, if anything, has changed. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We'll be back in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as isolation, depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment when you need professional help. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit betterhelp.com/1A to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
With civil unrest, the pandemic, and the economic crisis, you want to know what's happening right when you wake up. And that's why there is Up First, the news you need in about 10 minutes from NPR News. Listen every day.
This is 1A. I'm Jen White. We've been talking about Jacob Blake's shooting and its aftermath, but now we want to turn to another story from earlier this year. On March 13th, Breonna Taylor was killed by police in her Kentucky home in the middle of the night. Since then, Taylor's name has become a rallying cry for police accountability and justice. Celebrities like Oprah and Beyonce have rallied behind the cause. A painting of Breonna Taylor is even on the cover of Vanity Fair's September issue. But only one officer involved in her death has been fired. Does attention equal justice? What's the latest on the case? And what has our summer of racial reckoning accomplished for victims and their families? Joining us to discuss is Rayshawn Ray, professor of sociology at the University of Maryland and the David M. Rubenstein Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. It's great to have you back, Rayshawn.
Thank you for having me on.
And also with us, Amina Elahi, city reporter at WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. Amina, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Amina, can you give us a rundown on what we do know about the night Breonna Taylor was killed?
Yes, we know that police were executing a number of simultaneous warrants, all related to a single narcotics investigation, and that according to their own documents and statements, they believed that Breonna Taylor was a quote-unquote soft target. They thought she would probably be home alone, and she wasn't a main target of the investigation. One of the main targets was, in fact, an ex-boyfriend of hers. So when they arrived at her apartment that night, they said that they knocked on the door, they said who they were, and when they didn't get a response, they broke the door down. On the flip side, we learned from an interview with Kenneth Walker, her boyfriend, who was there with her that night, that they heard the knocking, but they couldn't tell who was on the other side. And I should note that the officers who were there were in plain clothes. So what he describes is hearing this loud knocking. He even says, you know, Breonna's yelling. She's saying, who's there? Who's there? We're trying to get dressed. We're trying to get to the door. It's after midnight. And as they're approaching the door, it comes off the hinges. So Kenneth Walker, in response, fires his gun, which strikes one of the officers in the leg. That officer later underwent surgery and has recovered. But that incident, that gunshot, prompted the other officers to fire back, three in total, and five of their bullets struck Breonna Taylor that night while she was in the hallway, and she died shortly after.
Well, Gail from Michigan writes, is it true that police involved in Breonna Taylor's death were following a legal procedure in their department, breaking in unannounced to serve a warrant? Although they were clearly negligent here, since I believe they had the wrong address, isn't that a different case than the abusive procedures involved in Blake's case? Amina, can you just answer Gail's question there about this no-knock warrant and whether or not they were at the wrong address?
The wrong address detail has been a really common bit of misinformation that has been linked to this case, and there are several, but this is a big one, is that they were at the wrong address. They were not. her name and her address were on the search warrant. They were on the affidavit that they submitted to get the search warrant, and they had submitted, some evidence that they believed linked her to, the main suspect in the case. And so, when it seems what's happening when people talk about this wrong address is maybe they feel like the police shouldn't have gone there because she was not, she was not believed to be as involved in the narcotics issues that they were investigating. But no, it is not true that the police were at the wrong address. Another thing that that is mentioned in that question regarding procedures is, I think, this question of the no-knock warrant and the fact that the police said they knocked, but they didn't, and said that they announced themselves, but there's some contradiction from Kenneth Walker on that. The police, because they were plainclothes and because of the division that they were in at the time, were not required to wear body cameras, so there's no way for us to know whether they did, in fact, announce that they were police before they broke down the door.
And Rayshawn, what's been the response from police in this case?
So I think part of what police have been trying to say is that they were following their protocols. And I think on the other side, a lot of people who are part of the public and people who are starting to better understand police policy and procedure, these are some of the problems that they have. I mean, obviously, as we just heard, if we had body-worn cameras, if they had them on them, some of these questions that we have would have been rectified. They would have been important, particularly when it comes to criminal or civil proceedings. But I think from a policing standpoint, they felt like that they were executing it from a perspective of good faith. Part of the issue, though, is if we look at the rate by which people's houses are raided by SWAT or similar types of units, despite people across race using drugs at similar rates, SWAT is deployed overwhelmingly for drugs in Black neighborhoods. And I think this is one of the problems that people have when they say they had the wrong address, that it's the perception that no matter who you are, what you do, if you are Black in America, you are perceived as being a criminal first and being potentially violent first, rather than being a person who should be perceived in good faith.
And explain what a no-knock warrant is exactly and what it gives police latitude to do.
So a no-knock warrant, and it's important for people to recognize that these types of warrants have to be approved by a judge. It is based on a series of evidentiary procedures and evidence that they have that gives them the ability to go into a house that they have probable cause, and oftentimes not even just probable cause, but they have actual evidence that they perceive that criminal activity is operating there. What's important again to note is that when these particular warrants are issued, they are disproportionately issued in certain types of communities. And even though people say, oh, well, that's because Black people are more likely to engage in violent crime, but in any given year, only around 5% of Black people get arrested for various types of crimes. So it becomes a gap in the disproportionality of the ways in which these no-knock warrants are allocated versus who is actually committing crime. And we know that this is the first time that this exact group of officers went into someone's house. A couple of years ago, they went into Mario Daugherty and his family's house in a similar sort of botched raid. So when people say that they had the wrong house or the wrong address, what they're saying is that simply because someone is seen with someone who might be engaging in criminal activity, that doesn't make them a criminal. And that doesn't give the police the right to knock down their door and come in.
Well, as we said, there are still some unknowns about what actually happened that night because we don't have any footage. But here's one question from a listener.
Hi, this is Dan from Lancaster, South Carolina. And I heard that that Brianna shooting was caused because as the police came to the door, the gentleman inside her apartment was shooting through the door and they were shooting back. Is that true? I'd like to know.
And Rayshawn, I want to give that to you, but I want to pair it with a tweet from Roger who says, what on earth do you expect the police to do when they are fired on, as in the case of Breonna Taylor? With Jacob Blake, he's refusing to comply, and the police didn't know if he was racing for a gun. Your response?
So my response is that if someone is coming into your house in plain clothes and it's difficult for you to hear, which according to what we heard, that was the case, that they didn't exactly know who was at the door, is that the people inside the home have the right to defend their home. And it's always interesting about who in America we frame as having the ability to fully enact their Second Amendment right and defend their family, and who doesn't. And I think this is an example of where we see this, that oftentimes when we see Black people having guns to defend themselves, they are still framed as criminals. I mean, in this regard, he was arrested, he was taken down. There is a reason why Louisville dropped all of the charges. It's because they realized they were wrong. And the unfortunate reality is that Breonna Taylor should still be alive today.
Well, along with the Louisville Police Department, the FBI is also investigating the death of Breonna Taylor, and we reached out for an update on the case. They sent us this statement. Quote, on June 19th, FBI Louisville returned to Breonna Taylor's apartment to execute a federal search warrant. Over 2 days of searching, the FBI collected a significant amount of ballistic evidence and completed a shooting reconstruction. This evidence is being tested and analyzed at the FBI laboratory in Quantico, Virginia. Once the FBI laboratory has completed its findings, FBI Louisville will promptly share our results with the Attorney General's office. We're talking about the latest in the Breonna Taylor case with Rayshawn Ray, professor of sociology at the University of Maryland, and the David M. Rubenstein Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, and with Amina Ilahi, city reporter at WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. We're also talking to you. More truth tweets. As long as we're reluctant to honestly admit that white law enforcement poses a problem to people of color, racial justice will not move forward. We also heard from Not Reaching, who says, I had police come to my home very early for an incident that didn't involve me. It was scary, confusing, and terrifying, and I was just waking up, which had me disoriented. We also heard from Calvin, who says, the only thing that's happened since Breonna Taylor's murder is more murders of Black or brown people. When a Black man can be shot in the back in front of children, how can there be any justification? Since the powers that be are condoning this, what's next? I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
Let's get back to our discussion about the Breonna Taylor case with Rayshawn Ray, professor of sociology at the University of Maryland, and the David M. Rubenstein Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, and Amina Ilahi, city reporter at WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. Amina, Breonna Taylor's death has sparked national outcry, but it seems like it was a slow build to that. Talk about how this has played out online and social media and in the media.
It's unfortunate in a sense that Breonna Taylor's death happened just as coronavirus was really taking hold in Kentucky, because that distracted a lot of people. Her family and supporters had been, you know, speaking out about this as soon as it happened. They had been trying to get people's attention, and local media did cover it. But, you know, with limited resources, it went sort of under the radar in a larger sense for some time. It wasn't until several weeks later that you started seeing more activists talking about it online, and you started seeing the start of these memes that are now familiar to many of us, featuring her face, featuring some details, often slightly off the mark, about what happened to her, and just trying to highlight the fact that she was killed in her home, you know, in the middle of the night by police, in a way that many people describe as unjust and tragic. So once it did start to reach the national audience and national attention, things started moving more quickly. We started seeing a little more action here locally. The mayor started responding a bit more. We saw some changes. And then George Floyd was killed. And it was around that time that protests really began in earnest in Louisville a few days after that. And they haven't stopped since.
How do Louisville residents think this investigation is being handled by officials? What's the sense on the ground?
It certainly depends on who you ask. Most people are unsatisfied in general, particularly because it's taking so long and so much of it has been kept private. So the police have wrapped up their internal investigation, but that hasn't been released to the public. You know, there are news entities that are suing to try to get that turned over. And it's all being held private until we believe, until the Kentucky Attorney General and the FBI complete their criminal investigations. And the argument is that that no one wants to interfere with those investigations. Unfortunately, we have no idea when those will be completed. So it's really just a waiting game, and a lot of people are upset and frustrated as a result.
Rayshawn, one of the things we've heard a lot over the past several months is the militarization of the police. There was the constant sound of helicopters overheard in Louisville while protests were happening this week, and we've seen officers dressed in riot gear at demonstrations. Talk a bit more about the call from activists to defund the police.
So activists have been talking about defund the police, and of course, we've been hearing at the Republican National Convention for the past 2 days, I expect, tonight and tomorrow, it'll be the same, of doubling down on framing Democrats, particularly Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and others, as aiming to dismantle police departments. It's important for people to recognize that defund the police does not mean abolish. They mean different things. So I'll quickly break it down. Defund the police means to reallocate funding. It means to reallocate funding away from police departments and public safety to other social services or other entities within municipalities to be able to respond to certain types of calls for service. Abolish means to completely dismantle the police department. And even oftentimes people who say abolish don't literally mean getting rid of policing. What they mean is what I framed as getting rid of the rotten tree. If anyone knows about planting in trees, that the roots are oftentimes 2 to 3 times as deep and strong as the actual tree we see. If you simply remove that, the roots grow back. So part of that is people are saying we have to completely reimagine policing. And then, of course, there are some who say we just shouldn't have law enforcement at all. But for people who say defund the police, they mean reallocating. And there are some very specific reasons as to why that makes sense, particularly from a market-driven standpoint. The first big thing deals with calls for service. 9 out of 10 calls for service for law enforcement have nothing to do with violence at all. Now, that doesn't mean that violence might not happen. But what it does mean is that overwhelmingly, these calls are from everything from potholes being in the street to traffic violations to various things that have happened between people. It might be that there are other people who are part of other social services who could respond to that. For example, dealing with a mental health issue, a person dealing with an addiction. It doesn't mean also that the police don't come to back that up. The second thing, of course, that people worry about with defund the police, and we've been hearing this rhetoric that defund the police, if it goes into effect, that it will essentially mean anarchy. That's not true at all. So I'll quickly highlight this. What might happen with defund the police, I think, the research I've done, shows that we might actually improve solving violent crime. What people have to realize is that the violent crime clearance rate is abhorrent. About 40% of all homicides go unsolved every year. About 66% of rapes go unsolved. And then we have about 50% of aggravated assaults and 70% of robberies that go unsolved. Police officers who I've studied, and I've worked with thousands of them, they are overworked and overstressed. If they had the ability to dig deep on certain types of cases, instead of always going wide on so many different types of cases, we might actually be able to solve violent crime better. And then the third thing, if we really, really want to solve violent crime, what we have to do is invest in education equity and work infrastructure, because part of thinking through this as well is that the response rates of law enforcement is bad in certain types of neighborhoods. So in predominantly Black communities, not only are those communities over-policed, meaning we're more likely to see police brutality and the effects of it, but then we are also more likely to see slower response times when they really need public safety. And those minutes matter when someone has had a heart attack or a stroke. So we're seeing defund the police across the board. It's something that's always happened, from Los Angeles to Prince George's County to Baltimore, where city councils are shifting funding away from policing to other entities. When we sit at a table for policy, we call it reallocating. It's just simply that defund the police gets the attention in the media, but this is something that's been going on, and it makes sense from a market-driven standpoint because people's tax dollars actually aren't paying off in the way they think.
I mean, there continues to be a lot of questions about the facts of this case, and a lot of, I guess, sort of conspiratorial questions about how this happened. Do we know what was at the root of the no-knock warrant and why police were issued that warrant more definitively?
The why how police were issued the warrant is a little bit in question, in the sense that there are a lot of questions about whether they justified the warrant sufficiently in terms of the evidence that they presented, the quality of the evidence, and how much consideration the judge put into signing off on the warrant. So while they technically, you know, went through all the steps and went through all the proper channels, there is a lot of concern that perhaps they didn't present enough evidence and that it wasn't good enough. In terms of how this all happened and some of the conspiracies about, you know, whether she was targeted or that sort of thing, and, you know, whether the main suspect was in custody by the time that police officers entered her apartment, some of that is you know, in conflict in terms of who you listen to and what some of the documents say. Some of the lawyers for Breonna Taylor's family, who are representing her family in a civil wrongful death lawsuit, have alleged that the police may have changed documents to alter the times that certain things took place. And some of those things we're going to have to wait to see, you know, what exactly is the truth, because of course the attorneys are trying to make a case for their client. And again, this is why I was saying that people are frustrated, because so much of what we're learning has come out, you know, either through the media or through through lawyers, and what we don't have is the sort of full documentation, the full understanding of what they've uncovered, and beyond the affidavit and the warrants that were issued, we don't know much more about the exact materials and evidence that they had collected.
Well, Breonna Taylor's mother, Tamika Palmer, spoke earlier this month after meeting with Attorney General Daniel Cameron, who took over the investigation in May, and Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher.
At this point, it's bigger than Breonna. It's bigger than just Black lives. It's, you know, it's about bridging the gaps between us and the police. It's about bringing back the communities. It's about just being able to stand up for each other and there definitely shouldn't be another Breonna Taylor anywhere.
Amina, have you gotten a sense of how the family feels about all the attention the case has received?
The family is clearly heartbroken. I mean, I think you can hear it in her mother's voice there that there's pain, and that pain, although months have passed, is not gone and will not be gone for a long time, if ever. That said, they seem to appreciate the public support and the attention and the pressure that people are putting on officials to get answers and get justice. And I would imagine that the fact that it was sort of quiet and didn't get a ton of attention early on contributes to that. You know, this feeling that, okay, people are paying attention now, and maybe that will lead to justice or some sort of result, does seem to come through in something as something that they appreciate.
Rayshawn, we'll wrap up with you. We're going through a summer of protest, but we started this show with another police shooting with Jacob Blake in Kenosha. Are we seeing a shift in the U.S. around policing?
You know, I think we are. So as bad as things seem, and as people feel like it is, and, you know, Will Smith is one of the people who really popularized the statement I'm about to say, which is that racism isn't getting worse, it's getting filmed. If we think about all of the incidents we know about, with the exception of Breonna Taylor, they have been recorded on film, from Christian Cooper to Ahmaud Arbery to George Floyd to now Jacob Blake. And accountability has came swiftly after having those particular documents. The Movement for Black Lives has made a lot of progress. I mean, not only on things that are individualistic in nature, like body-worn cameras and implicit bias trainings, which we do, and I think those are useful, but part of the shifting we're also seeing is accountability. The officers in Minneapolis have been fired, and then we also know that the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, if November changes, will go into law and really transform America.
That's Rayshawn Ray, professor of sociology at the University of Maryland and the David M. Rubenstein Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, and Amina Elahi, city reporter at WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. Thanks to you both for being here today. Remember, we have a text club. We'll only ever send you one text a day. It's the fastest way to connect with us, and details about how to sign up can be found in the Ask 1A tab at the1a.org. Today's producers were Michelle Harvin and Arfi Gatti. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again soon. This is 1A.